All right, apparently we are now live. So good evening and welcome to the ISOC at ICANN meeting. It's lovely to have you all here. We apologize for the somewhat late start. We had a slightly delayed entrance into this room, so we'll try and make time as much as we can. Before we proceed, I'm required to say that we're recording this session and it is being webcast. So if anyone has any objections, please let us know now. I didn't think so. Thank you. I look after the Asia-Pacific region for ISOC here. It's lovely to have our ISOC community in Singapore again. I think we've done this the second time in 2 years with an ICANN meeting in Singapore. So I'm hoping you've started to like our chili crabs and all the other good things we have here. With me on the table today, we've got Mr. Harish Pillai, who's the president of the Singapore chapter. As well, we've got James Wood, who's our new senior director of communications, and we'll hear from him shortly. And to my left, of course, is Ted Mooney, whom I think nearly everyone knows.
Or has heard from.
Yes, indeed. So you'll hear from all of us a little bit shortly. Before I get into that, I thought I'd very quickly just give you a brief overview of where we are with the Asia-Pacific region at ISOC. We have team members based across the region. We have a person, Naveed, who's based in Islamabad, Pakistan. We have Duangtep based in Bangkok. We have Noel based in Manila, and Amelia and Olivia based here in Singapore. And I usually live on aeroplanes, usually a 747, but sometimes an Airbus as well. Other than that, Sydney and Singapore are both homes for me. As we know, the Asia-Pacific is a very large and diverse region, and we have a lot of challenges in the region, technical and policy both. One of the other interesting things about the Asia-Pacific region, of course, is we've got all extremes of development. We've got the highly developed countries, like the country you're in right now, Singapore. And at the other extreme, we have countries like Myanmar, which is just coming into, let's say, the modern technology age. So there's a lot of work to be done. So I won't get into details on what we do, but what I would like to point out is that for 2014, the Asia-Pacific team produced a report. We called it The Year That Was. It's available on our website, so we invite you to have a look at that. It covers all the initiatives, or most of the initiatives and activities we did over the past, over 2014, as well as some forward-looking into what we would like to do in 2015. In terms of ISOC in the Asia-Pacific region, we have just around 22,500 members, so it's the largest region for ISOC globally. Globally, I think we have roughly about 71,000 members at the moment. These are individual members. We have 20 chapters in the region now, and just in the last couple of days, the administrative process for the newest chapter was completed, and our board will acknowledge them at their next board meeting, and that's the ISOC India Trivandrum chapter. I don't know if Satish Babu is in the room or not. He was going to be here a bit later. He's leading that effort, and congratulations to them, and of course we'll hear from the board as well when that's formalized. Much like ISOC and its ideals, the chapter community in the region is very multi-stakeholder, and I think we see a little bit of that in this room here as well, beyond the Asia-Pacific region as well. Speaking of policy, there's two things I'd like to highlight. We have a regional policy survey running, which closes tomorrow, I believe. We started doing that in the Asia-Pacific region last year, just to give us an idea of what people think about policy issues in the region. We invite you to participate. I think we've got a couple of thousand people who have responded so far, so we thank them for that, and we hope to have the results published in the next month or so. In addition to that, we have the Internet Governance Survey. As we all know, this year is pretty critical for Internet governance. That survey is done by our Global Public Policy Team, and I believe that closes on February the 20th, Sally?
Yep.
And we would really like you to respond to that, please, so if you could circulate that within your communities and get the feedback that we need to help us reach some perspectives on where we go with Internet governance. Last but not least, I have our friends from the Canadian chapter, Glenn and Evan, who are going to be, who will be running a video camera outside the room. What they want is little sound bites from you as you leave the room, basically saying who you are, and I think where you're from and which chapter you're from, and in your own language, preferably.
Also to say in your own language, I am the Internet Society.
I am the Internet Society in your own language, if you could please. So I would request that as you head out after the session today, please, if you could help us out doing that. Right, with that, thanks very much. I would now like to introduce Mr. Harish Pillay, president of the Singapore chapter. Harish is very well known in Singapore as well as in the region. I've known him for a couple of years now. Very energetic and active individual, and I'm really happy that he's taken over the reins from my other friend who founded the Singapore chapter, Peng Hua. He was supposed to be here. Peng Hua, are you in the room? There he is. Peng Hua's there. So without further ado, Harish, if you could say a few words about the Singapore chapter and what are you up to? Thank you.
All right, thanks, Raj. I think first thing I should say is I am the internet. So do we get set the meme going?
In Singlish, please.
I am the internet in Singlish as well. doesn't differ that much. Okay, I am the internet la. There you go. I think I say, right. Done.
Got it.
All right. Well, welcome all of you to the session, and on behalf of the Singapore chapter, I welcome and glad to see the fellowship that we have here. As you know, the chapter is fairly young. We are about four and a half, five years old, and we have been trying to do a lot of activities. But one of the big challenge we have is being in Singapore. Because of the nature of the internet in Singapore, it's in some sense a solved problem, access to the internet. So that part of the work that needs to be done that other chapters have are doing in their respective countries, we don't have that as an issue. So we need to therefore look at other things to consider what needs to be done and so on. So looking at a big picture in the last 12 months since we last spoke, actually, in this, I think, the same room, if I'm not wrong. This year, we have been the Internet Society Singapore chapter, for those of you who are not aware. We participated in bidding for the secretariat of the IANA transition group discussions. And so we have been awarded that, and so we are now running the secretariat for that very important task. It's actually something that we didn't expect to win, considering that we are a volunteer-driven society and so on. But I think the fact that we actually managed to get it for a very important function and transition that has to successfully be completed. Yeah, I think I'm very glad, and thanks to the folks who helped make that happen as well. So that was a highlight from my perspective. We are looking at many other activities as well from a Singapore chapter point of view. Like I noted earlier, right, internet access is not a problem in Singapore. So what we are trying to do is to create, for want of a better word, internet in a box activity. The notion is this: all satellite connections are down. There are no cell phone towers. There are no power stations. You have solar power. You may have a generator. You may have some fuel for the diesel generator. That's about all you have. And you got a whole bunch of laptops and wireless access points and so on. Build your own internet. So we want to get a bunch of kids together so that they'll have to craft and build an internet, whatever it may be, and give them a few hours to build it and then document it and record, as Raj was requesting, what happened, how did they go about doing it, and so on. So we're trying to do that so that we can then document and share it with the rest of the world. How do you go about doing something like this? So we're planning for that event in the month of March. So if you can be in Singapore, you're welcome to participate as well. March 15th is the date. It's a Sunday. So it'll be great if you can be here as well. We do have a few other things that we are planning for the rest of the year in terms of other reach-out activities, because our membership is always a critical thing. And so far, most of the events have been centered around policy-related stuff. So one of the things that we're looking at is about harassment issues online. We have recently, I think it is still a bill that is going through the Singapore legislative process about harassment online, so issues around that. And so we're looking at you know, great, generating enough conversations and discussions around it to see what it is that needs to be understood by, you know, people who use the internet here in Singapore at the very least. I think that's really what I just wanted to highlight to you. We do have some other activities like the IoT Asia event where we are participating, because the Internet of Things is a very important aspect of things happening. So the internet drives all of that. So there are issues around it. Now, I know there are many efforts in around IoT. I'm not sure whether there's a topic within this ICANN event, but I think that's an important area to look at. And if there's anyone who would like to contribute ideas and conversations around Internet of Things standards perspective, I welcome your contributions, and you know, you can reach out to me and we can see what we can do about that. Apart from that, I've got nothing else, much else to say except welcome again to Singapore and enjoy your chili crab. And I am the Internet La.
Thank you, Harish La. Before we start with the introductions of the people in the room, I would like to acknowledge the presence of our Board of Trustees in the room. They put in a lot of time to help ISOC achieve its ambitions and objectives, so we thank them for their efforts. And before I start calling out the names, if you could just give them a round of applause, please, for what they help us do. And we have Mr. Dave Faber, we have Sean Turner, we have Mr. Bob Hinton, who's also chair, Gihan Diaz, Hans-Peter Dittler, I see Narelle has joined us. Have I missed someone? And please don't shoot me if I have, or fire me. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you very much for joining us for this session. We really appreciate your time. Next, I'm told, Ted, that we'll pass the mic around the room.
That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to grab this mic.
Okay. So what we would like is for people to just say their name and their affiliation. Okay. and please, we are very time constrained, so I would appreciate if we could just quickly go through this process so we can get into some of the discussions. Thanks, Narelle.
I just wanted to say that as somebody who's worked in Singapore in the past, so I'm as you, some of you know, I'm an Australian. So forgive me for that. Sometimes I'm a little bit abrupt and very forthright. But I previously worked for a company called Optus, which was bought by a company called Singapore Telecommunications, Singtel. And so for a number of years that I was working for Optus, I would come across to Singapore and work very diligently. I would get off the aeroplane and go straight to the telephone exchange, and I would do some work, and I'd come back out and go to the hotel room, or sorry, go to the comm centre, and I would work away, and then I'd go to somewhere to a fabulous restaurant, eat really good food, and then I would scurry back down, repeat, until get on the aeroplane, go home again. And every day I would go, oh, we so much need a Singapore chapter of the Internet Society. If I had 5 minutes to spare, I would go up to the vice president of goodness knows what, or the executive vice president, and beg them to support this organisation. But unfortunately, I never succeeded. But these folk have done it. I'm so thrilled to see a Singapore chapter in place and working hard and doing really, really good things. So congratulations. And that's it from me. Hans-Peter?
Okay, Hans-Peter Dittler, Board of Trustees, and also from the German chapter of the Internet Society.
My name is Mei An. I'm the Executive Director for the Asia Cloud Computing Association.
I'm Gihan Bias, Board of Trustees, and also ISOC Sri Lanka.
I'm Bob Hinden. I chair the board. I'm a member of the San Francisco and the, I think it's the Intergalactic Chapter.
Yes, the Interplanetary
Chapter. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sean Turner. I'm also a member of the, I'm the Board of Trustees, and I'm also a member of the Washington, D.C. Chapter.
Dave Faber, I'm Board of Trustees in the New York and the Intergalactic Chapter. That's not what it's called.
Sally Wentworth, Vice President of Public Policy at the Internet Society and a member of the DC chapter, and I think New York too.
Scott Mansfield, I work for Ericsson. I'm the co-chair of the ISOC Advisory Council.
Suhaidi Hassan, I'm chair of ISOC Malaysia chapter.
Chair Solo, chair Kenya chapter. Carlos Gutierrez, ISOC Costa Rica, and I'm a member of the GNSO Council, and that's why I'm here. Thank you.
Tero Mustala, I work for Nokia, but I'm also a member of the Finnish ISOC chapter.
Hello, everyone. Bastiaan Goslings from the Amsterdam Internet Exchange, AMSIX, and also a board member of the Dutch ISOC chapter.
Bonsoir, Louis Hull, ISOC Quebec, and member of the NAMCOM committee for the ICANN for the second year.
Evan Leibovich, Canada chapter.
Desiree Milosevic, member of the Board of Trustees, but also a member of the UK ISOC England and Belgrade chapter.
Dan York, Internet staff, this week focused on DNS security.
Yrjö Länsipuro, ISOC Finland.
Waleed Al-Sakaf from one of the countries that's very difficult to operate the internet, Yemen. So we may need your project, actually, one day. I'm the chair of the Yemen chapter.
Hi, I'm Dina Vera. I'm part of the Israeli chapter.
Elisha Womaiko from Zambia, member of the Ghana chapter.
Esther Patricia Akello from the ISOC Uganda chapter.
My name is Wisdom Donko from Ghana. I'm the project and programs chair of Ghana chapter. And I'm an ICANN fellow, a coach for that matter.
Good evening. My name is Baburam Ariel from Nepal chapter. I'm chair of Nepal chapter. Thank you very much.
This is Mohammad Kausaruddin from Bangladesh Dhaka chapter.
Awal, Bangladesh Dhaka chapter.
Hi, good evening. My name is Tomohiro Fujisaki, ISOC Japan chapter chair, and also work for NTT, the organization member of ISOC.
Hi, good evening. I'm Toshio Tachibana from the ISOC Japan chapter, vice chair.
My name is Spencer Thomas. I'm from Grenada. I'm part of the ECTEL, which should be a chapter very soon. Thank you.
Malcolm Hutchie from Lynx, the London Internet Exchange, an advisory council member, and personally a member of the England UK chapter.
Isaac, a fellow for ICANN meeting from Mozambique.
Sophia Morales from the National University of Singapore, and teaching in the area of communications and new media.
Hi, I'm Ping Hua Ang from the Singapore chapter. I'm the vice president.
Yudo, co-chair for the Internet Society Indonesia Jakarta chapter.
Hi, I'm Yova. I'm a member of Internet Society Indonesian chapter.
Hi, I'm Judith Hellestein. I'm a council member on the Washington, D.C. chapter.
Aisha Hassan, senior director for stakeholder relations at the Internet Society.
I'm sitting next to Aisha Hassan. I'm Veni Malkovsky. I'm chair of the Internet Society of Bulgaria. I was wondering, is it interplanetary network, the thing that Vintsev develops? And this gentleman in the front who said that they're working on the interplanetary net, for those of you who sit in the back, don't worry. This is the network that Mr. Putin is going to use because Angela Merkel said he's from another planet.
Okay. Bernard Thomas, Director of Telecommunications in the Commonwealth of Dominica. No, this is not the Dominican Republic. It's the Commonwealth of Dominica. And we are soon to have a chapter in Dominica.
I'm Park from Korean chapter, ISOC Korean chapter. I'm board member there.
YJ Park, chair of ISOC Korea chapter.
Holly Reich, Australian chapter and on the ALAC executive.
Hi, I'm Craig Ng from Australian chapter of the ISOC as well, on the board and the treasurer. I work for thank you. I work for APNIC as its general counsel and also on the CRISP team with my colleague here for the numbers proposal.
I'm Nurani Nimpuno. I'm a board member of the ISOC SE chapter. I'm also with NetNode, who is an organizational member, and I'm also on the CRISP team and wear a few other hats.
I'm proud of it.
I'm proud of it.
Yes. Let's hear it for the CRISP team because they finished on time. Yay. I'm Salam Yamut. I'm the General Secretary for the Lebanon ISOC chapter. I work for the Prime Minister of Lebanon and also I'm the on the board of RIPE NCC.
My name is Fiona Songa, ISOC Kenya chapter, and I sit in very many different capacities. I cannot begin to give a list.
I hope we'll get a clap this time. My name is Sean Ojadeji. I'm on the CWG for stewardship. How about the clap? Okay. We'll finish someday, don't worry. I'm from the Nigeria chapter.
My name is Tim McGinnis. I'm currently a member of the DC chapter, formerly a founding member of the Kenya chapter. Former member of the Dutch chapter. For some reason, I'm in the member of the Mauritius chapter, even though I never lived there. But I am currently the registry administrator for the Dot Pharmacy TLD.
My name is Konstantinos Komaitis, and I'm with the policy department of the Internet Society.
Hello, everyone. My name is Izumi Okutani. I'm one of the co-chairs of the AC with Scott and Russ White, who's actually not here, and a member of the Japan chapter, and I'm chairing the CRIS team, and so working together with Craig and Rani.
Hi, everyone. My name is Siranush Vardanyan. I am from ISOC Armenia chapter board member and also chair of Asia-Pacific region in ICANN at large.
My name is Lin Sin Sin. I'm born in the internet.
Aris Ignacio, we don't have any intergalactic or interplanetary projects, and I'm from ISOC Philippines.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Chris Mulola. I am from Rwanda. Thank you so much.
Hi, everyone. This is Leon Sanchez from MISOC, Mexico.
Martin Levy, member of the San Francisco Bay ISOC. I'm just a guy that uses the internet a lot. No board member, nothing.
Hi, Satish Babu from the 5th Internet Society chapter in India. Also the latest, we were born yesterday. Thank you very much for the very warm welcome. It was a very smooth process for us to start the chapter. I have to place on record the contributions of everybody who supported, but particularly Naveed. So thanks again and hoping to work with you. I am also part of the ICANN nomination committee.
I am Zach Lee. I'm from Progress Software. I'm a volunteer for APNIC Apricot. I use the internet a lot. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Glenn McKnight, part of the Canadian contingent, and thanks.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lynn Hamilton, and I'm also from the Canadian chapter.
Hello, I'm Vanessa Ching. I'm from the Media Alliance. I'm not yet a member.
I'm Christopher Gomez. I'm just an observer today. I'm a member of the ACM, and all your chapters belong to us.
I am Shiva Bisesa, not a member, but representative of Trinidad and Tobago.
Lawrence Olari Roberts is my name, a first-time fellow with ICANN from Nigeria and an interested member.
Mariella Pacito, Telecom Italia. We just joined ISOC, so please be merciful.
This is Olivia Loy, Singapore ISOC, based in Singapore, I mean.
Lynn McNair, Senior Director of Partnership Development at ISOC.
Amelia, you're based in Singapore, working for ISOC.
Iran Borisova, member of the Washington, D.C. chapter.
David McCauley, member of the Washington, D.C. chapter.
36 so far. 36 chapters represented and 10 or 11 organizations. We have some other. I see Shiva, and once Shiva has a chance to introduce himself, we're going to go online because we have some participants on our WebEx session as well.
Shiva Subramaniam, Internet Society India, Chennai chapter.
Thank you, Shiva. And now let's see if we can't get our participants online to introduce themselves.
This is Mike Nelson with the Washington, D.C. chapter. Glad to see such a great turnout. And I'm also working for Cloudflare now on public policy issues.
Hi, I'm Lana Gass from ISOC Armenia chapter, board member. Nice to see all the presents there.
I see Jolie, I see Raul. Jolly's muted. Right. Fair enough. Raul?
Hi, everybody. This is Raul Echeverria, Vice President for Global Engagement and Relations Internet Society. Nice to see the good participation. Unfortunately, I'm not with you there, sharing with the room with all those colleagues, but I hope that the meeting is very good for those attending.
And we have one other person, Shranju Kanamori. Who's muted for the time being? Yes, Victor?
Everyone.
There he is.
I'm Victor, board member of ISOC Cameroon chapter. I'm now in Atlanta, Georgia, planning to form a ISOC Greater Atlanta Area chapter. So soon I will be setting up a new chapter here in Georgia, USA.
And Winthrop?
Yes, good evening. I'm Winthrop Liu, Internet Society Philippines chapter.
Outstanding. Norel, how many does that make? 30. Well, the Atlanta chapter isn't official yet, so you can't count that.
Yes, we did.
Yes. All right. So 39. I think it's close. I think there might be one more. Anyway, fantastic attendance. Thank you all very much.
Great to see the diversity and the representation. Thank you very much for attending. So because of the somewhat late start to this meeting, we'll have to see how we can be a bit more efficient in the use of time. So next off, I'd like to introduce James Wood, who's the newest member on staff and who joined us very recently. James's title is Senior Director for Communications. So instead of me talking about him, I'd rather let him talk about himself and a little bit of what he's going to be doing at ISOC. So, James, thank you.
Thank you, Raj, very much. First off, can I just say it's incredible how so much of the world can gather in one room, but the real achievement here is the breadth and depth of the representation across ISOC. You should all give yourselves a round of applause. It's amazing. So, obviously, this is an opportunity to introduce myself. I would like to just say a few words about my role and its focus. I come from a communications and public relations background, which shouldn't be a surprise given the role that I'm now in. I've worked with some of the world's most recognizable technology brands. I've worked with some of the world's smallest technology brands, some of which are very esoteric. I've worked across broadcast technology, mobile telephony, and digital content, but I've never believed more in a technology than I believe in the internet. Not only that, but I believe in one that's open, resilient, and secure. So I find it a little strange that how little attention traditionally the world has paid to the internet, despite our being so dependent on it. But I'm now seeing a world that's waking up to the internet. We're moving, I think, from blind acceptance and taking the internet for granted to a world where people are taking an increasing interest in the internet as a global resource and how it relates to them as individuals. So this is good news. People are talking about the internet. And as an important foundational organization of the internet, I believe we have a really important part to play in directing this discussion, working together to bring new thinking to the dialogue. We belong in the global conversation for the internet, and I believe that our collective voice needs to be heard clearly in actual fact. So in my role, this is why I'm focused on building the internet society's visibility and profile. This is key for me this year. Changing perceptions, aligning key stakeholders with our values, and increasing our sphere of influence and reaching new audiences. So I think we need to cement our position as a true authority on the internet and be recognized for being the key internet organization that we are. So as we plan our activity for 2015, which we're in the midst of doing currently, I'm really focused on telling our story better and ensuring that the internet conversation comes to us rather than us trying to find it. So I'm really looking forward to meeting all of you in person, coordinating with you, listening to you in order to move our voice forward and to increase its share of mind around the world. Thank you.
So with that, let's welcome James to the family. Yeah. Welcome, James.
No one just says a newbie now.
No one newbie. You've lost that title. That's it, gone. Okay, thanks very much. So next, I would like to apologize. There was another trustee in the room, and I thought I would miss someone. Desiree, my apologies. You're here as well. Now, we'd polled the membership on two topics that we would like to discuss as part of this session. Two that floated up to the top were security versus privacy and the INA transition. I'm pretty much sure that with the IANA transition, we pretty much transitioned out so far this week. So I would like us to perhaps, let's start off with security and privacy and see how we go time-wise, and then we'll see if we get to the second topic. However, before I do that, Evan, I would like to give you that couple of minutes if you were to talk about the Chapter Advisory Council. So Evan asked if you could speak very briefly on the Chapter Advisory Council before we move on to the main session. So Evan, 3 minutes, four at best. Yeah, for the streaming and all that, yeah, thanks.
Hi there, good evening. Again, my name's Evan Leibovich. Normally I do my stuff for the Canada chapter. But I, together with John Moore from the DC chapter, have been involved with trying to finally put together the charter for the Chapter Advisory Council. It's been a long time in the making, and just as a matter of update, I found out as of this afternoon that the charter has gone through legal review, and so it's getting near the final stages. We have done webcasts. John and myself have participated in every region, hopefully, that we've received feedback from all of you. And generally, it's been all incorporated into the document. It looks, as far as I'm concerned, very good. It's received the input from chapters, from staff, now from legal. We've been speaking to a number of board members. It's my hope that when the board meets, when the trustees meet, that they'll give this consideration and send this to the next step. At a certain point, I believe either staff or somebody else will be getting back to all the chapters to basically give you a last opportunity to have a look at it, make sure that there's consensus that this is that you like it in its current form. I hope when you do see it that you will give it your consent, and I'm hoping to see some good things. We've got, there's a lot of good things that the council can do, and I'm looking forward with all of you to seeing it put in motion. So thanks very much.
Thanks, Evan. All right, so moving on to our topic of security versus privacy online. This, of course, is a pretty wide topic as such, depending on your perspective and where you place yourself in the conversation. So to help kickstart the discussions, I'll call on my colleague Dan York, who's part of the Deploy 360 team, and a very active writer. I'm sure some of you have seen some of his blog posts and commentary that he does. So Dan, could I hand over to you to kick things off?
Sure, and I'm going to stand up a little bit, actually, to just kind of move this around. So we had this broad topic to talk about security and privacy, and that was brought up by folks who are here. I guess the question I would ask you all is, what would you like to hear us talk about with regard to security and privacy? Because there's a wide range of things there that we could speak on. What issues do you see as members, as chapters, as others? What are the concerns that you'd like to understand where the Internet Society is on and what we're thinking about how we can address those issues? Just hurl them out. Yes. Oh, here.
I think it's important to strike a balance between the security needs and privacy concerns, and that we should not worry too much. I mean, take too many measures to about security, so much so that it affects our civil liberties.
Funny about that. We were having that conversation, and actually I put up a blog post a little while ago about this fundamental tension that we have between, and this is one of the things that we all have to factor when we talk about security, is this tension between security and safety and privacy. Because if you look at it, we have this issue, right, that let's just take the security side, governments, our own selves, want to be able to protect the security and safety of their citizens. They're, you know, and if a member of my family were to be in some kind of, you know, kidnap or something like this, I would want the law enforcement to do everything possible they could to resolve that situation, you know, just individually. We all want that in some way. We want that kind of security. We want that kind of safety. By the same token, I don't want the government to have access to necessarily all my private information, nor do I want other governments or other agencies or other entities to have this. So there is this balance between security and privacy. And one of the points that we've certainly been looking at is, oh, okay, no, that was no, sorry, Howie was doing some symbol over there and I thought he was telling me to, you know, okay. So, you know, privacy signals here or something. no, but you know, there's this thing, right? Because if you get now, Jim, you know, we need to protect our privacy. We need to look at this, and you know, as governments, we were specifically this being raised in the context of the UK Prime Minister David Cameron's remarks about the fact that he wanted to say that any kind of communication applications that worked in that were used across the internet had to provide some mechanism for the government to be able to intercept them and work with them. You know, and you start to look at that, how do you, you know, that would clearly say we want the priority to be around the security and the safety. But the challenge we all look at is if you make a backdoor, if you make something available to that for a government, it's, you can't do it halfway. If it's available to somebody, it can be available to somebody else. And you can be available to some other government, some other entity, some other agency, something like that. You know, and as a technical community, the Internet Architecture Board, part of the IETF, has made a statement saying that we now want to, the IEB is encouraging that all protocols from this point forward, you know, have encryption as their default. You know, we as in the technical community, the view is we want to encrypt everything. We want to do that and provide that higher level of security and privacy. Part of our challenge, I think, is as advocates of that point of view, is to point out to some of those governments and to others that they need to safeguard the security and privacy, the information of their citizens, of their businesses, of their folks that are there. So there is this tension, you know, between the security and understanding the legitimate needs of entities and agencies to provide that protection to their citizens with the right that we all wish to have of the privacy of our own information. And this tension is going to be one of these fundamental public policy issues and debates that we're going to be having over these next years. You know, we're moving all of our communication online, right? You know, we talk about the public switch telephone network, the PSTN, and the movement to take all of that and shut down the traditional circuit switched, you know, architecture, all that, the infrastructure, and move that all to be online. Well, now all of a sudden, you're getting all that traditional telecom infrastructure with which the law enforcement agencies used to be able to intercept with warrants and all the lawful access elements. We're moving all of that online, okay? And now they're saying, hey, wait, pause. We used to be able to do that. We want to do that now. And plus, you have this other dynamic that people are moving away from the traditional telecom into using other apps and other things that are just completely separate. WebRTC, this new mechanism that's coming out, baking voice and things right into the web browser infrastructure, is all encrypted and it's all completely separate from the traditional infrastructure. So there's a lot of these challenges that we're going to have to navigate through. And that's going to be a lot of what's going to consume our time, I think, and the time ahead around that. So I think it's an excellent question. And this is the question that we're all going to have to figure that out. Our societies are going to have to figure that out. Different countries are going to fall down in different places on that continuum of security and privacy, you know, and some are going to fall more one way than others. And we as an organization are going to have to work in that space, you know, and help, ideally we'll help guide people toward more of, you know, somewhere in the middle or more on the privacy side to the degree that we can, but we'll have to see. Yes. Oh, Venny, did you want to say something? All right. Are we getting another mic? Okay. I've been sitting down too long, so thank you for indulging me standing up. Venny.
No, I was actually going to say that we are going into a couple of points. First of all, if the discussion is about privacy and security, people tend to constantly talk about governments. And I was watching this morning one of the news stations on TV, and I'm more concerned about the Samsung TV, which apparently is sending to third parties all the conversations that you have while it's on. That's what we were told. We don't know if it's not sending stuff or if somebody's not going to hack to send stuff at all times. And then the second question is, since we are at ICANN, and there are other issues about privacy and security within this context. So, like, who is databases and websites that you have to figure out to whom they belong, or on the contrary, you have to figure out a way not to disclose to whom they belong. So, don't misunderstand me, the government party is important. And, you know, when David Cameron or somebody else says something, that obviously resonates a lot. But according to a recent study, I think it was in Russia, and I'll end with that, the fastest readers of English are actually the Russians, because it takes them about 0.2 seconds between reviewing the terms and conditions of using iPhone and clicking on the yes. So we don't know what we are actually using, because I bet you nobody has read those.
So, and you raise a great point, too. We talk about, you know, you just mentioned it, the Samsung TVs. You know, we're on this verge of the whole Internet of Things, right? The IoT, as we talk about this, and embedded devices and putting more and more devices on the network. And, you know, Venny, to your point, if your refrigerator, you know, is wired up to be able to go and tell you when you need to go buy milk, or some of the ideas that people say that, oh, you no longer have milk in there, I'm going to order it through your store and it's going to show up at your doorstep. You know, there's a lot of convenience in there that many people will probably embrace because it's super convenient. Never have to worry about that. Milk just shows up when I'm low. In the meantime, you know, who's tracking the milk that I am, you know, where's that data going? You know, we have a group in our organization that talks about, you know, data privacy and looking at where that all is. Yes,
I'm sorry, but I have to ask a complicated question. Who say that we have any privacy?
Well, yeah.
We're talking about security versus privacy. I'm not sure that we have any privacy.
So the question for the live stream is, do we have any privacy anyway?
That's
That should be the question.
Yes.
If we still have any privacy, because anything that goes online goes.
Exactly. I mean, this is the question, right? Do we have any privacy? And what privacy do we want as users? Should we have privacy? What level of steps are we willing to go through to get privacy?
The real question shouldn't be what privacy we have. Instead of it, we have to ask which kind of privacy are we teaching our children to have? Because they don't understand privacy at all. They don't know what privacy means. Our children.
Our children.
They don't understand privacy at all. And if we want to talk about privacy, we have to talk about it. I was in a movie with my daughter. We ended the movie and we were outside and we got a message from Google, buy the book, it's great. You're laughing. I wanted to cry.
It's funny. This whole thing with David Cameron gave me a lot of flashbacks to the early 1990s when a number of us were all engaged in the U.S. fighting the Clipper chip, which was the U.S. and NSA's attempt to put this chip into all telecom devices so that there's a back door that they could listen into your conversations. And we were all super concerned about they'd listen into all these sensitive things we would have. You know, fast forward 20 years, we're putting all that sensitive stuff in Facebook, you know, and Google Plus and everything else, and we're giving it all away to unknown, you know, to corporations who are doing whatever with it. So, yeah, our sensitivities change. Evan, before I go to you, this gentleman up here wants to say something.
I think having a discussion about the policy issues and, you know, as we're having right now is critical to have. But I think I would like to propose that we look at specific things that we can actually do. Let me get a show of hands here. How many of you have a PGP key? All right. So we do have some of us who have got who use PGP keys for signing, for encryption. Can we at least at a chapter level, across all the chapters, start a key signing project or at least have the communication done in a cryptographic manner? Let us start first. Because if we don't do it ourselves, and I will need to get all of the others who don't have a key as well. Mm-hmm. Oh, you do. I didn't see your hand. Okay. Because I think by practical means, by doing that, we will then get the action in motion and the thinking behind it and the lessons that we will learn along the way. So at least you've got something concrete to start with. So I would like at least at the end of this conversation to have an action plan that we do a PGP-related activity.
Sounds good. Evan?
I was going to talk for a moment about health data, which is something totally beyond this, because it's one thing for people to say, I'm going to give away information because I'm going to get free stuff in return. But how many people know that the health information that's being kept on them could be sent to insurance companies and things like that, and that has very real effects in the here and now.
Yes.
And potentially, at least in the circles we've been talking in our own policy group, has deeper implications than government snooping. And so there's concerns about that. But also, I wanted to speak very briefly about the PGP thing. It's well and good for the people in this room, most of whom, show of hands, lots of people use PGP. And then I'm going to go home and I'm going to talk to my parents about, hey, would you like to do PGP? There's a massive problem right now that has to do with a horrible set of tools for doing this. And I think we possibly have a role to play in making these tools accessible. Things like PGP is great if you're into geekdom and horrible if you're not. And that's a massive barrier to security, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's the user experience around security needs to be simple because...
You had your hand up and then Salam and then...
Yeah, we've got a queue going on here. So, but yeah, I mean, point, you're absolutely right. It's got to be the user experience is simple. That's why PGP is not as ubiquitous as it could have been. I mean, I was somebody trying to teach people to do PGP, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and it was like, you know, same thing. Yes.
Yes, again, Waleed Al-Sakaf from Yemen.
Yes.
ISOC Yemen. The thing is that we have a dilemma. The dilemma is obvious here that the thing is that we tell people, you know what, you're not secure. You always need to have a secure password, and it should be I don't know, at least 10 letters, and then it has characters and numbers and capitals and smalls, and then and not only that, you should always renew it, and then you should also have different passwords for the 20 accounts that you have. So how many
And then you do what Sean's done and write it down in the sticky note in the front of his laptop so he can...
Exactly.
So well, I mean, he didn't, but you know.
The thing is that while we want people to be secure, we also need to provide a usable security, alternatives that make things easier. And I think that as chapters, we have to come up with solutions to this and present ideas that are workable in reality. We're not living in a bubble. We are part of the mainstream. So I think that's the direction we should put. Thank you.
Yes, I mean, looking at ways to make it accessible and to help people understand how to do some of those things, tutorials, you know, sessions that you can do as chapters. Yes, back there.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's a point that already has been said. I think we're not anymore in the paradigm of security versus privacy. We're in a new paradigm. And internet society, nobody can help me protect. I mean, you cannot help me protect myself, right? If I decide to put my data on Facebook and Twitter, and which we are deciding to do because we want to do, and the new generation, you know, my kids, they know that this data is public in a way for everybody. So I would expect internet society to educate me about the solutions that exist out there about security, about these random number generators and the way that they break into code, and to most of all educate me about the new paradigm of the big data and what can be done, what is being done with the data, so then I can become like a educated consumer of technology.
Yeah. I see we've got a couple more folks floating around.
Can I just add one comment here? Today, by the way, is February the 10th, the Safer Internet Day.
Yeah. Mm. Very
so,
true.
Timely.
Yes, I saw. Yep.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I stand up. All right. My name is Esther from Uganda, ISOC chapter. Yes, I have two comments. One is okay, I forget your name. You mentioned about the use of PGP for security as some like a starting point for security. But I stand to either slightly differ, and I stand to be corrected. A major issue with security, okay, especially for my country, it's something to do with, okay, the privacy issue is kind of tied to government interests. And one thing I'm aware of is that much as you may use encryption keys and all that, most governments don't accept you to use, say, encryption software if they do not have the decryption key.
Right, they want to have the back door to get into that, yes.
Yes, so they will still access that data anyway if they're interested in it. They will always get access to it. And I'm just wondering if we're talking about privacy, if as long as government is involved in it and they have their interests, they will always access that data anyway. Maybe we should, and going back to her question about do we have any privacy, actually I would almost agree with her. There is no privacy at all for as long as you put your data on the internet. When you're accessing several websites, you're required to enter so much information, subscriptions online. There's a lot of information that goes out there for you to access some of this information online. So there's almost no privacy online. So maybe we should focus on, maybe we should focus on how to teach people and sensitize users that on how they can't stay secure or access secure content, but use of, and they should be aware that privacy or whatever they put up online is actually public information and it's not in their control.
So, absolutely. Now, how many of you have seen the digital footprint effort, the work that was done here that the Internet Society Trust and Identity team did? Okay, a few people in here. There's a learning program that was put online. It's called Your Digital Footprint. You can find it off there, and it's a set of learning things around helping you learn what is your digital footprint online, what trails are you leaving, what are you doing out there, how can you protect yourself a bit more. It's on our website. We can make sure to get that out to folks. But that's a program, certainly, that you could use in your chapter to go and look at that and how you could help do that. You raise an important point, though. Like I said before, in this room, we've got a wide variety of different, you know, governments, different government structures, different ways that are here. What's possible in my country, I live in the U.S. and things, I can use things like PGP. I can use other stronger encryption programs without the government having a backdoor. Whereas in your government, in your region, you may not be able to do that. You know, and honestly, in the U.S., we had a period of time where it looked like encryption very strongly could have been outlawed, that we would not have been able to do that. That was fought back in our country, so it is. But in your country, it may not be. This is, we've got a wide range of things. I saw Sean wanted to answer something here.
So just remember, if you're going to a service and it's free, you're the product, right? So think about that. That's basically it. Oh, I guess the other thing is the usability of security is a problem because us nerds like to make it hard. So we're starting now to try to make things a little easier to implement. So there's some things like there's an ACME proposal in the IETF. It's about trying to make it easier to get certificates installed on web browsers to start up SSL connections. And it's basically ongoing now, and it's available on GitHub. It's ACME, and you can just download it and start using it and go for broke.
Sean didn't introduce himself at the beginning to say that he's also the area director for security. Oh, no, was. That's right. I'm sorry. He was the area director for security, so he has a lot of exposure to what's happening in the standards body of that. I saw David wanted to chime in.
Yeah, just a comment. Well, it's very important for the Internet Society, this area, realize that in many countries there are other organizations which have been doing good work in this area, and we should coordinate with them when appropriate.
Absolutely. I thought maybe I'm going to pick on Holly from ISOC Australia. There's a significant piece of legislation moving through Australia on data retention, and the chapter's been very involved. I thought it might be of interest to this group. Sorry.
It is a very interesting piece of legislation. If it were drafted properly, what it would do is require data retention for a period of 2 years, a range of data about name, address, duration, destination, so forth, with lots of statements, we really don't want the content, and then you have to look at the wording and realize they do. It would involve the telcos, but also ISPs, and there's a nifty little subsection in there that basically says if you don't have the systems to actually retain the data, you'll have to get them. The good news is it's appallingly drafted. And when we in the Internet Society appeared before the committee, we'd actually prepared a submission pointing out some of the kind of major holes, and they were very interested. I have to say, we had a really good hearing, and they said, could we actually give them an additional submission pointing out in more detail what the problems were. And I'm not sure whether it's a good or a bad thing, but we did. I won't even go into the loopholes, except I think the feeling of the society is somehow the intention of this government is to get something through. The hope is that by the time they finish amending the Act so it actually works or works better, it will be somewhere down the track. And because the committee that we appeared for is bipartisan, and our objections, not our objections, our comments as to what is everything that's wrong with it will mean it's going to take some time and some significant redrafting, which will hopefully delay, hopefully stall for a very long time, the government intention. But I don't think the government's intention is going to go away forever.
So Holly brings up an excellent point, too, which is that how many of us really trust our government legislators to have an understanding of how the internet works? Louis does?
I don't answer, I trust, I want to have a microphone.
Oh.
So I've got a long line here, people
okay.
with their hands
so,
up.
But this is an important part. This is an important point, right? The legislators and the folks, I mean, who are creating this legislation don't understand it, right? The internet's this magic cloud where stuff happens and things go on. And to them, many of them who have come from a telecom background in some way, why shouldn't they be able to just say that it works this way? Because it worked that way for 100 years with telecom. Why can't I just legislate this? So one of the things that we all need to be constantly doing is helping them understand. And, you know, what you're doing back there in Australia sounds exactly in that line of helping them understand. What are the real ramifications of writing it this way? And one of the campaigns that we're looking at as the Internet Society over this next year is really around this whole issue of security and cybersecurity and helping people understand more of this. So you're going to see from those of us who are, you know, employed by the Internet Society, we're going to see more stuff coming out about that, more documents, more content. But we also need your feedback, your assistance with that. Things like, you know, what Holly has been doing to the degree that you can share that kind of information. You know, we've got this Connect system. How many of you are using Connect? Okay, a number of folks. This is this sharing system we have internally to help us share this. You know, if you've got questions that are coming up or things you would like to hear us be able to talk about, you know, if you'd like to get a nice summary of the points you should be talking about on these issues, you know, you could say, my government just raised this legislation, which is crazy. Here's these points. Can anybody help me out? We've got all sorts of people in this room who can share with each other that information and do that. Okay.
So and we've got Charles here, and then I think we have an online.
We have an online, and Louis wants it, and okay. Everybody wants it.
Thank you, Glenn, for that presentation. Now, I think security is a very big challenge. Like in Kenya, for example, last year, we were talking about actually one of the lawmakers who was a chief guest during our Internet Governance Forum confined to us that the members of parliament who pass these laws don't understand the bills that are brought to them. That's why we've been having these bills of data protection and security pending in parliament for a long time because they don't know what to do with it. So, even the judiciary also as well. You know, they're not trained in ICT and security. So it's been a very big challenge. As a country, Kenya, for example, we are being faced by the issue of Al-Shabaab. So now, the government tells people now which one is important. So the government sees the security of the people more important than the privacy. So it's a very big challenge to us as ISOC chapters, but what we're trying to do is to try to engage them, for example, with a proposal to try and touch educating the legislators on issues of ICT and security, social media, by using that portal, which is online, so that they could get acquainted with the issues, that we actually understand the whole context, and so that we can reach a general consensus.
Right, you know, because we saw that in the wake of the Paris attacks, you know, that happened just recently. All these governments wanted to immediately go and try to do something, and in lack of understanding, you know, they're trying to say, we want to do this. It's up to us to try to help help them understand what are you really going to do if you do that? You're absolutely right. And they want to jump in that way. I hear we have a question.
No, he's put his hand down.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I wanted to add the NASA direction of it. We in Europe, or especially in Germany, have governments who believe now that there's something which is called the cloud and big data and whatever, and suddenly they get a feeling they have to protect the privacy somehow, and they try to do it by a regulation or legislation of what a company can do in the cloud. I think that's a very dangerous way accessing this problem, and we should think before governments start really doing such legislation for arguments why it's sometimes silly and why it's sometimes really hurting the internet. So that's only an additional point.
So I've got a couple people here.
Yeah, this whole big data, I mean, and people don't understand what is the cloud really? You know, where does it actually reside? Yes.
Okay, it's interesting that we're hearing about cybersecurity, and a colleague here from Australia is talking about the issue of data retention and the government's action. In Dominica, we are working on cybersecurity. We have some pieces of cybersecurity legislation. I am working with the Council of Europe and the OAS on the whole issue of cybersecurity and Data Protection Act. And part of the legislation calls for a certain retention of service of data by the service providers, the telecom service providers. I mean, that is necessary because you have all these funny things going on, and you should be able to have the service providers to provide information in real time if there's any kind of issues of pornography and so forth in cybercrime. So the question is, how much data can you keep? Now, we tell them, okay, you need at least 3 years of data. They say no, because we have to have a bigger switch. So we have issues of how much data can you retain versus the criminality of the cybercrime. So we have to strike a balance somewhere.
Yes, and there's the balance, right, of how much of that data do you want to have collected at all in some places, and how do you log in? And then there's the technical realities, right, of how do you even log all that kind of thing if you were to do it? But how do you do it? And you know, to your point, in your area, the government may want to do that. And over in Peters, the government has specifically put in legislation which says that no personally identifiable information can be tracked at all, period. You know, so again, we're a global organization here with lots of different things, and somebody is...
A couple more points. First of all, Christine Runiger some time ago ran a really good policy session just on copyright, which is extremely useful because the issue is not going to go away. We can use it in the debates that are ongoing because those debates are going to go. My suggestion would be something like that on the issue of privacy or even particularly data retention would be really useful, to so that there is a basic ISOC understanding of what the issues are and a comparison of data regimes throughout, which gives us all a really good basis to start with. The other point I want to make is, and it's follow-up from Vinny because he wasn't particularly specific, the ICANN meetings have been involved really in who is, and the whole issue about do you retain registrant data, what do you do about privacy proxy servers, and the whole kind of paradigm shift that's going on to what's called the expert working group, where in fact you have a completely different, you start from a different place, which is not all data is public. But that'll take years to implement. So there's so much going on in ICANN right now about that whole issue, and there should be a watching brief that you guys have on that.
Okay, thank you for that feedback. I want to go about another 5 minutes, and I want to check in on this. So I know we've got a couple folks in the queue, and I saw Louis in there too, and this gentleman. Okay.
Thank you. I'm Malcolm Hutty. I'm from the United Kingdom, and I must say there's never a topic as much as this gets me as close as wanting to apologize for that. Because I'm afraid my country has been very much not only at the heart of this debate, but at the forefront of it. We've been the exemplar for a lot of this in driving these policies forward. My government has, amongst the developed world, we've driven it in a large extent. We've driven the European legislation. But what you said earlier, I'm afraid it's not my experience from the United Kingdom. You said that they don't understand, that they need explanation of what the implications of doing this are. Now, of course, you know, it's certainly my experience that ordinary members of Parliament don't understand the technology and so forth, but that doesn't really matter because it's the security and intelligence establishment that drives the policy on this, and they do understand. They know exactly what they're doing. They know exactly why they want to do it, and they believe that they want to know. I mean, the policy that they're trying to push at the moment is based on the principle that they want to know, have a record of every form of electronic communication that anyone sends by any means whatsoever, all the time. Yeah, that's what they're aiming for. And it's not a lack of understanding, it's a difference of values. They believe that is something that they need to do to keep us safe. So I don't think the Internet Society can help us at all in explaining what the technology is and why this would be difficult or how this would cost and all the rest of it. What is needed is an explanation of the harm that that will do to the information society. So that those that don't know or care about the technology but are making the decision on the basis of is this needed to keep us safe will actually understand the principle of what will be lost in return. That's what we need from you.
Bingo. I mean, that's exactly right on that, as far as, because you're right. And in my country, certainly other agencies have similarly, you know, been involved with the legislation and such that's out there. So you're right on the tech on that level. But a lot of the people who are voting on that, that's really what I was saying, on the parliament or the Congress side, they don't understand what they're voting for. And so in lack of that, they'll just say, well, yeah, it's going to protect the country. It'll make us safe. It'll be good. I'm being pointed to. ISOC Philippines is actively engaged with privacy initiatives in the Philippines, including the National Privacy Forum on February 18th. Noel will attend the event, and Winthrop will be presenting. All right. Louis.
That's great. 3 points. We are the Internet Society. But I will just give 3 little examples. We're talking about security and privacy. All right, I've been a journalist. Both of them are not needed for a journalist. You don't want to have privacy. You want to access information. And you probably need security to access information, not the opposite. And it's still right today. For anybody who wants to, you know, a scoop, well, this is a different definition of privacy and security. Example number one. Example number two, security. I've been, after being a journalist, I've been in the database business. Yeah, you need security because this is your business. This is your daily money, all right? But in the meantime, maybe some information is collected and you don't know. After being in the private sector, I've been working for the government. One of the nice things that I've done very soon, I went in Hartford, Connecticut to give a paper on the geomatic plan of the government. All right, 20 years later, I've been 30 years within the government. What you were talking about a little bit earlier is there a mapping of your information? Well, an information that I didn't even remember, that Hartford paper that I gave, it was on the Internet. Internet didn't exist when I gave the paper, but it was there. So you have a print. When an information is digital, it's going to be available forever. How? Well, this is so. We were talking about governments who would, they have nice plans, you know, and they have legislations, and they're going to do it. Being there for 30 years, it'll take 18 months. By the time it's in force, it's obsolete, more or less. Something else have moved. Maybe it'll be good for a short while, short period of time. But you just can't only count on government for regulating security and privacy. There's been improvement. There's been, you gave the example of what's been done, wholly with who is. You're perfectly right. But we have to realize that at the end, we need a multi-stakeholder model to fix all those problems. There's not only one solution.
Well said. And also, you know, some of these consumer issues, the items that have happened out there, you know, the privacy of organizations that have had this exposed. Look at Sony, look at some of these other organizations. You know, they're being punished in some ways through the public sphere in some forms, or the pushback around this, around different products and things. I saw somebody.
There we go.
Yes. And a couple more, and then we've got to move on. Let's see, one in the back. And you've been trying for a while. We'll get you in there.
When it comes to security and privacy, why is it that whenever government is mentioned, the issue of privacy and security creeps in? We have noticed that most of the applications we install on our mobile phones. We don't read the agreements behind those. We don't even read. How does an application that has to do with weather go to do with my SMS, my phone book, my location? Okay, the location I can understand because of the weather, but it goes deep. All we do is we just go and sign in without actually reading the actual agreement before I install that application. Two, from what I've seen, the governments, most governments in Africa have no capacity actually to survey on its citizen, because basically governments are always backwards. Citizens are always ahead of the governments. But we tend to put security and privacy every time the way the government is mentioned. And yet we don't know that the same government can still get my data from Google. The same government can still get my data from Facebook. So at the end of the day, I trust the private entity whose agenda I do not even know. And yet the government, probably where I work, whose people I know, I don't trust them.
There's a great paper that just recently came out from UNESCO that we were involved with that was talking about the intermediaries on the internet and talking about this role of these intermediary agencies, the Facebooks, the corporations, and all of this. And if you look back, anybody remember the future scenarios that the Internet Society did in, I think it was 2008, 2009? We looked at some of the different paths that the internet could go through, and one was, you know, that it winds up being owned by mega corporations. And, you know, we're pretty far down that path in some ways. I'll give you another one, too. You know, how many people have Fitbit or other similar health trackers? Or, you know, to track the number of steps you have? Yeah, I see a number of people out there. Or you use things on your phones, heartbeat, blood, or you're using one of these new watches that do all that? Where's all this data going, you know? I get a little nice little email that tells me how many steps I've walked in the past week, okay, and whether I've walked more steps than my wife. Okay, I have no clue about Fitbit's data retention policies or where that data is stored or where it is or anything else. I'm making the choice because, as Sean said, if it's free, you know, you're the product. I'm using this because it's free and easy and it provides a certain level of convenience. People out there are making these choices. Part of our responsibility as the Internet Society, I think, or our, you know, what we can do is to help educate people around those choices. What are they doing? Are they sure they want to do that? I saw back in the back, and then I think we have one more. Yeah, I'll give you my mic. Okay. Yes.
Sorry. My name is Chris Mulola. I am from ISOC Rwanda. I have just a simple question, or maybe I don't know. How can you ensure privacy when it is possible for any government to just walk to your email service provider and download all your emails? That's my first one. The second is maybe a comment, and or maybe again a question. I think it's possible to kind of talk security. Like, for example, here we're using an open Wi-Fi, and it's easy for somebody who is got the skills to kind of copy everything you're doing. So I think we can just tolerate. That's my comment. Thank you.
Well, so two answers to that. I mean, one is, right, it all depends upon your level of security concern. Like when I'm on here on this network, okay, I'm a security I'm a little bit on the paranoid side. So I run a VPN off of my laptop back to another service. So, you know, if you all are trying to sniff the traffic coming off my laptop, sorry, I'm protected. But I'm a security geek, okay? I do that kind of stuff. The average citizen doesn't. The only reason they're generally using VPNs is because they want to look at Netflix from some other part of the world or something like that. Quite honestly, there's some VPN. Yeah. Or they want to, you know, somebody in our workshop yesterday who was talking to me about, she's from China, and she was asking me about why she is blocked from seeing Facebook when she's in her country, but when she VPNs out to the US, she can look at Facebook. It's like, well, there you go. But back to your email provider, the question, that goes back to, where is your email server? You know, part of the question that we have is, if you're using something like, you know, one of the public email services that might be located in the US or somewhere else or something like that, then your government in Rwanda might not be able to get to them. Now, there's other secure services that have come up that are out there that provide secure email, or some version of that you have to connect into their, they in theory they don't have any access to your data. But now perhaps, and I don't know, your government may block any kind of outbound connections to external email servers. They may force you to use email servers that are in the country. And depending upon your internet infrastructure, they may have that ability. So again, it goes back into these challenges of different spaces. And this he's been asked.
Okay, there are two things. One, sometimes the measures that are meant to guarantee security actually end up endangering security, and it works in a counterproductive way. It raises a lot of security issues by themselves, the measures taken. And the other thing is that I've always observed that when a government wants you to be transparent, wants your actions to be transparent, it's almost like they want you behind a glass door while they stay behind an opaque and well-protected wall. And have you ever seen a government office in camera? While you're on camera, your movements are tracked. You step out of the door in the street and you're always on camera. But does that happen on the other end? Is it a two-way process? Just one more thing, and on this topic of security versus privacy, we did a workshop in 2009 at Egypt where Bruce Neer was one of the panelists, and so that is archived, and I put the link on the WebEx.
Excellent, and yes, I mean, this is, it's this continuum, right? The same, the argument that's made as we talk about encrypt everything, the law enforcement agencies come back and say, well, then, the terrorists can encrypt everything. And the right, it's that trade-off that, where do you come in on that continuum? Where are you in the security and safety versus the privacy and the trade-offs that happen in all of that? The gentleman over here was asking about the government. Why do we always talk about the government stuff? I think perhaps for some of us who have been in this space and technology and public privacy space, all the Snowden revelations of the past year and such have really brought it, and the government reactions to that have brought it up, that when we talk about security and privacy, you're right, we do tend to lead with government issues and government surveillance and pervasive surveillance. But the pervasive surveillance by corporations is just as much as some of the governments and other entities that are out there. Yes.
Yeah, I think it's symptomatic that people are dusting off the old mechanical typewriters and using them for sensitive jobs, and that there is a good aftermarket, secondary market for old Nokia phones. At least I read somewhere that drug dealers are using the old Nokia, was it 8120 or something, because that's very difficult to track. So that perhaps there is a message here for those who design and develop technology. I mean, perhaps people start valuing more a privacy than convenience, which is doubtful anyway. The other thing, you ask how many our legislators know about technology and all. We used to have one, but unfortunately he lost the election. But we, ISOC Finland, we see as one of our tasks to try to educate the legislators, and especially their aides, because they are more actually, the propensity to get new information is higher there, and also some bureaucrats too. And this is what we do, for instance, by the Finnish Internet Forum, where we want to get these people in. Thank you.
Okay, I think we have one more question in the back.
I guess I would just, how many of you in your countries, if you've read about this, in my country we have more and more cyber policymakers, right? Some countries it's a cyber czar or a cyber ambassador, cybersecurity. It's the latest job description. In the U.S., I was just reading, there's another agency being formed. Heaven help us. But, you just think about the multiplicity now of policymakers in this space that 5 years ago you would have, that job description didn't exist. It's really phenomenal. So yes, last one, maybe?
Well, we've got, and then over in the corner.
Okay.
Yes. You've been raising your hand. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, actually, I'm an advocate of all the security stuff, but I think all these are rather in vain because there's this thing called lawful intercept. So whatever you encrypt, don't encrypt, and whatever, you know, the Cisco has already made this device very long ago. And I trust and I believe that government agencies are buying all these instruments. So when they want to act at any time, anywhere, they just do the LI, finish. So I'd like to hear your comments. Thank you.
Sure. So I think we could probably get into a longer discussion on that. But there's the interesting aspect is that the beauty of the internet, the permissionless innovation that we all talk about, has enabled all sorts of companies to go and create new solutions that, you know, are unbreakable in the encryption. You know, Sean and I could have a communication session using some of these new things, a WebRTC, some mechanism that provides a mechanism that you and I, or that he and I could have this conversation very securely that no government could get into. All right, you know, somebody with quantum, you know, whatever. But, I mean, the encryption is strong enough that it's there, and we're seeing this, which is this challenge, right? Because governments of the world have been used to having lawful intercept. And now, as they confront the fact that WhatsApp is completely encrypted, when I have a WhatsApp communication with you, okay, from me to you in our mobile phones out here, all of a sudden law enforcement is saying, hey, hold on, I can't get to that communication. I want to get to that communication. Now, WhatsApp is big enough, and it's part of Facebook, who could probably be leaned on by governments to be able to go in there and get that. All right, WhatsApp can be. But the little startup that goes and created that I've downloaded and you've downloaded, and we're doing peer-to-peer direct encrypted communication between us, all right, that can't be broken. That there is no lawful intercept. And this is that challenge because the governments are saying, we want that lawful intercept. We want that ability. And where does it come down and what's there? That's the challenge we all face because each government in this room is going to have a slightly different answer. The government of Uganda over here is going to have a very different answer than the government of Germany. Okay, very different. You know, and probably true, I see the gentleman in Rwanda, you know, moving his head there too in acknowledgement. His government probably has a different view on what's, you know, there versus Louis here in Canada. Although your prime minister, I don't know, you know. All right, in the corner.
Another voice from Canada. I think one of the reason why, you know, we love the Internet Society is that we can hopefully share a lot of best practices. When global events happen, governments respond and they have to speak to their voters and their voters want to feel safe and they want to get reelected. So I think it's contingent on all of us to learn to speak what I will affectionately refer to as polidiot. And you have to be able to communicate technical language yes. to politicians yes. and be able to communicate it to voters so that when the cybersecurity people come in and tell governments who don't know anything about, you know, what this is going to mean, that dialogue can happen. And when you're on the front lines, especially if you're in D.C. and Canada and some of the G8 countries, we're going to hit it first. And in a meaningful way that we can actually have the discussion with voters. So anything that we can do as the Internet Society to start harnessing those best practices, harnessing the talking points, harness those things so that we can share them not only with our decision makers, but also with our citizenry to make them more educated. Because at the end of the day, for most of us, unfortunately not all of us, we get to vote them out. So if you want to make that happen, we have to be very smart, very savvy, and what's Mr. Oliver? You know, if you want to, we have to be really funny, and we have to be compelling, and we have to make those messages count so that citizens listen to us, and they're not just railing on the door of government, but we're saying, voters are smart, and let's educate them.
Awesome. That was an awesome way to end. Thank you. Okay, because that is the key point. We do have best practices. We do have that. And so as we bring this up, although Rudy wants to say something, and he tells me it's a tiny bit, but tiny.
A very short question. I would like to know the temperature of the room in the sense of I would like
degrees.
You to raise your hand if you think, if you consider that your government is taking care of cybersecurity in your country. Raise your hand if you're thinking they are doing.
Define cybersecurity.
Great, that's what I thought.
define cybersecurity. Okay.
because, I mean, you know, I know that my government's got a pretty big honking program to protect itself from all the other governments out there. Okay, you know, so, but this is the question, too. What is cybersecurity? What's the cloud? What's all these terms there? Oh, I know. What's all these things? Okay, we have other things. We have vigilante groups out there that are doing different things. I mean, all sorts of stuff. But I want to come back to this point in the back about best practices, all right? This security, cybersecurity issue is this top pressing issue, I think, in all across the, you know, the world, in the policy sphere. This is really one of the top issues that we're seeing out there. And we're seeing it at all levels. And as users, you know what? There's a whole lot of people in the United States who are really upset because their healthcare information just got attacked last week and dumped out there. Something like 80 million people may have had their social security number, their identity number, exposed to the world, okay, out there through the Anthem, the second largest provider of stuff in there. There's a lot of people who are starting to get really concerned about this. So one request to all of you, all right, we as the Internet Society staff, you know, part of what we're looking at is how we can help you with materials, with things, with ways to help talk about this to the point you made in the back. What's your name? I'm sorry. Lynn? Okay, so Lynn made that point about how can we talk about this. All right, we're going to do our part, but, you know, we're only a small group of people as compared to the rest of you out here as well. All right, so what I would say to this is, as you folks are out there talking to your governments, Lynn, if you in Canada create some good documents that you create, that you use to share, or if you create a video around this, or if you create a web page, if you do that, share that. Let us know. We've got email. We've got Connect. Post this as an example and say, you know what? They proposed this crazy legislation in Canada. We created this document and sent it, this website, and we sent it around to our folks. Okay, you know, in Uganda, we created this type of document. In Quebec, you know, wherever you are, what is this saying? Threat. Who's posting malware to the? Okay, but I mean, this is the thing, right? In Yemen, all right, wherever you folks are, post this stuff. Let us know and share it, even if it's not in a language that others may understand. Let us know, because we can maybe if it's something really good in Swahili, we can help with getting that into other languages. Help us share that information so together we can help look at how we make the internet more secure. All right. Thank you all for this time. Let's summarize. I think we've got a couple of key things I heard here. One was there's interest in doing something around PGP. And are you interested in sort of taking the lead on that? Okay. And what was your name again? Harish. All right, Harish from the yeah, we know him. All right, so he's willing to take the lead on that. All right, so I also heard interest around big data, around data retention, around having some information around that. Certainly something that will take us as feedback around pieces that you're looking for, and feedback around how to talk in more regular. What did you call it? Polydiat? I mean, we may not call it that on our website, but okay, but that kind of terminology, something like that. I heard, what were some other points we heard here? Action items that were out of here. Usable security. The digital footprint, okay? The digital footprint would be something else that we'll circulate around to folks to let you know about that, because it is something that can be used. Also, some of the other materials that we put out, some of the scenario work, some of the pieces that are there to let people understand what's there. The intermediary report. Okay, hopefully we've captured this somehow in this. All right.
On encryption that cannot be broken that you are having with,
yeah.
Is there a certain level of encryption that you could share with everyone?
So the question was about encryption that can't be broken. Can we share some of that? I mean, certainly we can talk about some of the different tools that are out there. Sure. What? Cryptek. Sean, here, you say something about that quick.
So one of the concerns that came out about in the Snowden revelations was that the HSMs, the hardware security modules, are owned. So one of the things, basically, that they can be hacked easily, or that the keys can be given away. So one of the things that ISOC is actually doing is sponsoring a program called Cryptek, which is trying to have an open source hardware development stuff, and they're still in the kind of beginning phase of trying to figure this out. But it'll be interesting to see if they can succeed, because the big concern about security is how far down the rabbit hole you want to go, right? Do you trust the program you're using to write the code that programmed the thing? And if you don't, then you've got to go. I mean, the people that are doing this are uber paranoid, and that's where they're going, or they're trying to stop themselves from going off the ledge. So it's really a question of how far do you want to go. But it's definitely something that the idea is that essentially you could build one of these things from components that you got at like Radio Shack. Sorry, I guess that went out of business. But it's someplace else. And the idea is that you could use this to basically protect internet infrastructure where the keys for DNSSEC and stuff like that are actually stored. So, yeah. That's
good. All right. I think that's a good point to call it. So thank you. And let's continue these discussions online.
Okay. Thanks very much, Dan. And thanks for the participation. Much appreciated. Just before we leave, I'd like to share some statistics that I mentioned at the beginning that we were doing a regional survey. So thanks to the beauty of the internet, one of my team members, Naveed, based in Pakistan, was listening to this conversation. So he quickly pulled up some statistics for us. Out of the survey that we've got so far, this is the regional survey, so it's just Asia Pacific. 36% are dissatisfied with internet policy making in their country, and 45% are only somewhat satisfied. Privacy ranks as one of the top five concerns for people in the region. 70% said cybersecurity is just as important as civil liberty, and I think Siva in the beginning made a point about civil liberties and cybersecurity. 67% said protection of online privacy should be guaranteed under national law. And the other interesting bit I thought out of all these statistics, 46% of the respondents for all those were between the ages of 25 and 34. So a bit food for thought, perhaps. And with that, I'll turn to Harish for some closing remarks before we call it a night. Thank you.
Thank you, Dad. I just wanted to, final comment, very glad to have the discussion that we have had. I think there are some action items, and I'm very happy to take a lead on making sure we can create a user-friendly PGP front end for every one of us to be able to use in whatever form that we want to use. And let's try and put a deadline to it, because a meeting like this needs to have an action item, and I would like that to be an action item that we can probably review at the next ICANN or next ISOC meeting or whatever. All right, so thank you very much for coming to Singapore, and this is the internet, La.
Thank you.